I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Is there a more iconic symbol of the Wild West than the rancher, wrangler, or buckaroo? The art of working livestock from the back of a horse, though, is more than just an American phenomenon. Today, we'll explore the true history of a cowboy. Then, environmentalist Bill McKibben has spent years raising awareness and calling for action on global warming and reducing fossil fuel use. We'll discuss what he's calling the hottest fight in the hottest decade. After that, meet a man who, very literally, has climbed into an active volcano further down than the Empire State Building is tall and lived to tell the tale. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What is it about cowboys that fascinates us even to this day? Maybe it's life in the outdoors, a cowboy sitting proud atop a horse that draws us. Or maybe it's the idea of the lonesome hero going after bad guys in the Old West. Well, Michael Grauer is here to set us straight. He's speaking at the Kansas City Public Library later this week. And he joins us now by Skype from Amarillo, Texas, where he directs the curatorial staff at the Panhandle Plains Historical Museum in Canyon, Texas, and oversees the art, weapons, militaria, sports, and cowboy and ranching collections. He's also on the faculty at West Texas A&M University. He was born in KCK, and he's a proud KU graduate. So good to have you here, Michael. Welcome.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
I want our listeners to know who we've got as a guest today. Do I understand right that you once turned down a dinner invitation to the White House, Michael? And how in the world did that happen?
Well, it wasn't exactly turning it down. It was just a matter of a scheduling conflict. My son was graduating from high school, and I had to make a decision whether to eat supper with the president or be there when he graduated, and that was an easy decision for me.
Why did the president want to have dinner with you?
Well, I'm sorry?
Why did the president want to have dinner with you?
We loaned some art objects to the White House, and in fact, one of the objects that was painted or that was lent to the White House was by an artist who's hanging at the Kansas City Public Library right now, who specialized in paintings of longhorn cattle. So that's the story there.
Well, today we're talking about cowboys, and you're not here to tell me that cowboys really weren't all that much like what I used to watch on TV, are you?
No, I'm actually not. That's what my job is on Thursdays, to kind of set the record straight on what cowboys really were and what they weren't. And most of what we see in popular culture, especially in films, are Westerns, not cowboy movies. And that's what we're going to talk about on Thursday.
But that's how we see the cowboy. That's how most Americans see them, is what we used to watch in those black and white movies or TV shows or whatever it was, right?
Right, exactly. And the first thing that Hollywood put in a cowboy's hand was a gun. And unfortunately, that's not something that was a normal part of a cowboy's toolkit. But unfortunately, Hollywood took that. Popular culture had done that before that in printed media, and then Hollywood picked it up and exaggerated it to a great extent. And that's what we see today.
Why didn't cowboys have guns, Michael?
Well, it's an interesting thing because, you know, a man mounted on the back of a horse doing cow work really had no need for a firearm. I mean, there was really no place for that. And frankly, they got in the way. And so ultimately what happens in Texas is in 1871, the Texas legislature passes a law against the open carry of firearms, not specific to cowboys, but ultimately they realized that this had no place in cow work. And so they really get in the way. Unfortunately, what happens is in popular culture, cowboys become gunmen and ultimately become crime fighters and superheroes and all this other stuff when the regular cowboy didn't do any of that business.
So what did regular cowboys do?
Well, you know, cow work is basically managing someone else's cattle from the back of a horse, managing horses as well. And this is a technology that actually, pardon me, scholars have studied as to, you know, where is cowboy ground zero? Where did this whole idea come from? these technologies that they used. And scholars today pretty much circle back to North and West Africa, which is where these herding tendencies came from, circled through through Spain and eventually to Mexico and on up into Texas and into North America. And so basically what it boils down to is managing these herds, a product that's going to be sold in a place like Kansas City packaged in Kansas City to feed the rest of the rest of America and the rest of the world. So ultimately, that hired man on horseback, is critical to the building of America.
So you're saying the first cowboys came from Africa and from Europe?
Ultimately, they did. When North Africa conquered Spain in the 8th century, those technologies of managing animals from the back of a horse are carried over into Spain, southern Spain primarily, and then those technologies are brought to the New World when Spanish conquest happened in Central America and ultimately Mexico. At the same time, by the 16th century, West African slaves who use roping techniques, those are brought to Central America and ultimately to North America as well. So it's a combination of technologies from North and West Africa that informs what cowboys ultimately used in what we're more familiar with in the 19th century.
Was it as romantic a job as we like to think that it was?
You know, that's a great question, and I get that a lot because I do a lot of lecturing on cowboys. Is, you know, the attraction that was put out there, that, and as you said in your intro, the, you know, to ride free on the back of a horse, the wind blowing in your hair, and all that stuff. You know, that was part of the. I don't want to call it a marketing campaign, but popular culture certainly played into that. And so a lot of young men, especially young men, came out west into Texas and in western Kansas and in Colorado and Oklahoma and places like that, expecting it to be, you know, just riding around all day and having a good time on the back of a horse. And they found out pretty soon that first of all, it was hard work. It was dirty. It was dangerous. And largely it was boring because, you know, you're dealing with animals that are dumb as a box of rocks when you're talking about cows. And that doesn't get terribly exciting. And it didn't fit the dime novels that these people back in Chicago or Boston or even Finland or Germany that had been reading about these things. And it was nothing like that. It was largely dangerous work. And you got no wages. I mean, the standard wage for an American cowboy between 1880 and 1930 was $1 a day. Mm. And that's not a way to get rich. It's certainly not.
So you can't have a conversation with a cow when you're out herding animals, right?
Well, you could have a conversation, but they tend not to answer too well.
Yeah,
but, you know, the whole thing about, you know, being in love with your horse or your horse is your best friend. You know, most people don't realize the cowboys didn't even own their horses. The ranch owned the horses, or the trail driving outfit, they owned the horses. You might own your rig, which would be your saddle and your clothing, but you really didn't own much of anything. And so, you know, having conversation with cows or horses, that's perfectly legitimate. Plus, you're usually far away from the other cowhands and there's really nobody to talk to. And, you know, you can't, I guess they could have checked their Facebook status while they're on the back of a horse.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing.
And Twitter and everything else.
Yeah, right. Snapchat each other, you know, across the herd.
Michael Grauer speaks at 6:30 Thursday evening on the true history of cowboys. This will be at the Central Library downtown at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. What was the particular challenge of herding animals on horseback, Michael?
Well, first of all, they're unpredictable. First of all, you're riding an animal that's unpredictable, and that's the horse. And then cows, as I said before, are not geniuses. And, you know, they go where they're wanting to go, and some of them could be trained, and some of them could be trained for just a couple of minutes, and then they'd go back to the way they used to do things. So, you know, they used to say that every morning in a cow camp was a rodeo because, you know, your horses are cold, and they don't want you on their back. They're not your best friend. And so there was a lot of pitching and fighting with firstly getting mounted. And then, of course, the cows, they don't want to go where you want them to go, and getting them to walk away from their bed ground and so on. You know, that's always a challenge. And so it wasn't easy. And that's the key. It was always hard work. And the main thing was unpredictable. You never knew what they were going to do.
You know, the Ken Burns documentary about the American West would have me believe that, you know, most cowboys quit the work after a single cattle drive. Why such high turnover?
That's actually very accurate. You know, we hear about, you know, down here in Texas, you know, there are legends and mythologies about, you know, grandpa went up the trail 12 times to Dodge City or to Abilene, Kansas. Well, most of the time grandpa was a liar because it was just too hard and it was too dangerous, especially in crossing Texas and crossing up into what was then Indian territory, now Oklahoma, and up into Kansas. It was crossing the rivers that was usually the most dangerous. And cowboys had a notorious fear of water because most of them couldn't swim. Hmm. And so it was the work was just too hard. It was just too hard. And most of them, if they did a trail drive, they did it once. And many of them just quit on the way. They just couldn't deal with it. It wasn't nearly as romantic as they'd been led to believe. And it was just too hard and grim and dangerous.
You say there were different types of cowboys. How so?
That's exactly right. You know, most cowboys, generally to the statistics that we know of, during the trail drive era, which is basically the end of the Civil War up until about 1890, we estimate there are about 35,000 trail hands. Two-thirds of those were Anglo or Euro-Americans. The other third were largely either African-American or Hispanic or American Indian cowboys. Most people don't realize that some of the earliest cowboys were actually Indians. And then in some very rare cases, there were women who were passing as men. And so there were a great mix. And amongst the Euro-Americans, they could come from just about any European country, Russian cowboys, Finnish cowboys, French cowboys, British cowboys, for example. So they came from all walks of life. And most of them, we found from our research, is that most of them didn't want to be lifetime cowboys. Most of them dreamed of having either their own small ranch or, and this really flies in the face of popular culture, most of them want to be farmers.
Huh. What do we know, Michael, about how they got along with each other?
Well, generally, there was a certain cohesion in camp, a sort of a fraternity type situation. But generally, there would from time to time have a bad seed or a bad apple come into the bunch, and they didn't last very long. They usually rousted out. The wagon boss was usually fire them because they knew you had to operate as a unit. Because usually a trail crew numbered anywhere from 10 to 12 cowboys, and they all had their roles. And if someone was counterproductive in that situation, you just didn't want them around. So they usually got fired, handed their wages, and sent on their way. So there was generally pretty good relationships between all the cowboys.
You also say that there are lots of tall tales out there when it comes to cowboys, such as...
Well, you know, the mythology of the firearm. And, you know, what I found in my own research is even cowboys themselves on into the early part of the 20th century started to believe their own myths. And I've read interviews with cowboys who said, we believe we were supposed to carry guns. And I read an interview where a cowboy said, we didn't think we were a man until we could carry a six shooter and roll a Bull Durham cigarette with one hand while at full gallop. You know, and that's just crazy B-movie Western stuff. So, you know, that's one of them. And, of course, they were always solving crimes or helping damsels in distress. And that plays into a lot the whole idea of the knight errant of the plains. You know, they're just the natural successors of Robin Hood and all that sort of stuff back from earlier mythology.
I've got to ask you, how did a kid from Kansas City, Kansas, and who attended KU become so interested in cowboys?
Well, as soon as I could read, I read anything I could pick my hands up on the American West, and I've been fascinated by that ever since I grew up in Kansas City and Kansas City North, and ended up at KU and continued with my interest in the American West and went into art history that dealt with the West and also history as well. I ended up at Smithsonian, worked at the American Art Museum, and then back grad school in Dallas, and then out here to Panhandle Plains Museum, which is the largest history museum in the state of Texas. And so I take care of those artifacts that relate to people like Quanah Parker, famous Comanche, and Charles Goodnight, one of the, you know, often called the king of the cowboys. So it's a great honor and it's a privilege to take care of these things, but I need to know about them. And so that's where my research comes in, is making sure I get the story right, because no one can speak for them except for people like me.
Today, you're well known as Cowboy Mike, a Wild West performer. What do you do as Cowboy Mike?
Well, I'm not so sure about the Wild West part, but I've been doing a living history program called Cowboy Mike for almost a decade now, and I speak to the little critters as well as the older ones, and one of the things that's a great pleasure to me is to watch everyone become a child before my very eyes, whether they're 8 or 80 years old. Everyone always dreamed at one time or another of being a cowboy. And the rig that I wear, which is correct for the period that I present, you can just see people come alive as I tell stories about how cowboys really were. And you can see those dreams sort of run through their eyes as I'm talking.
Michael Grauer speaks at 6:30 Thursday evening on the true history of cowboys. This will be at the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Michael, thanks so much.
Oh, much obliged, sir. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll talk with Bill McKibben, the author of The End of Time, about global warming 28 years after he warned the world about it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we discussed what the massacre in Las Vegas could mean for local Second Amendment advocates. We also learned about the future of online grocery shopping. You can find those conversations at kcur.org or on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, meet the director coming to Kansas City and the KC rep, who's bringing a legendary August Wilson play to life. Also, we'll speak with two Kansas City women who've spent years trying to curb violence. That's tomorrow on our show. Well, back in 1989, Bill McKibben's book, The End of Time, was the first to explain the issue of global warming. 28 years later, the renowned environmentalist is still at the forefront of the effort to end our reliance on fossil fuels. McKibben will be at UMKC on Friday to deliver a Cockafair Chair lecture, but this morning he joins us via Skype. And Bill, nice to have you. Good morning.
Very good to be with you.
Your book, Bill, came out 28 years ago. What do you make of the fact that it's taken us so long to embrace this idea of global warming, and still, obviously, some of us haven't?
Well, I think that I'm afraid to say that the reason that it's taken us so long is now pretty clear. It's been the diligent work of the fossil fuel industry to keep us from taking it seriously.
What are they doing?
Well, here's what we know now. About 3 years ago, some of the best investigative journalists in the country, at the Los Angeles Times, at the Columbia Journalism School, elsewhere, started unearthing a treasure trove of documents from the biggest oil companies, particularly from Exxon, the biggest oil company, indeed the biggest company in the world for much of the last 50 years. And they showed that beginning in the late 1970s and early 1980s, Exxon knew pretty much everything there was to know about climate change. I mean, they were a very rich company. They had great scientists, and their product was carbon. So it stands to reason that they would have been investigating. Their scientists predicted accurately how much it would warm and how fast. Exxon's management believed them. They began doing things like building their drilling rigs to compensate for the sea level rise they knew was coming. But they didn't tell the rest of us. Instead, they spent hundreds of millions, billions, building the kind of architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that kept a completely phony debate alive for 25 years about whether global warming was real. As it turns out, both sides in this debate, the fossil fuel industry and the science community, knew that global warming was real. Just one side wasn't letting on what it knew. Because we've wasted that time, we're now way behind the eight ball here. I mean, when I wrote The End of Nature in 1989, there was still something abstract and theoretical about this problem. By this point, you know, we've lost half the summer sea ice in the Arctic. The oceans are about 30% more acidic, and as a result of that and the heat in the oceans, we're losing huge swaths of coral reef year after year. We have altered fundamentally the hydrological cycle of the planet, the way that water moves around the Earth, because warm air holds more water vapor than cold. That's how we were able to have, say, the largest rainstorm in American history a month ago, when Hurricane Harvey dropped as much as 54 inches of rain on parts of Texas. all in all, we're in a very bad place here. And the thing that probably makes it worse is that to this day, our leaders, including our president, have been, well, I guess they've bought into that disinformation campaign. Our president believes that climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese, which is an extremely odd thing to believe.
What do you make of what the fossil fuel industry did back in the day when it comes to deceiving the rest of us, not telling the rest of us what it already knew?
Well, I think that there's at this point no doubt that it's probably the biggest corporate crime of all time. I mean, the tobacco industry took us out one smoker at a time, but the Exxons of the world are going big. I mean, they're doing it one planet at a time. They're being investigated now, finally, though the statute of limitations has passed for much of this. But Eric Schneiderman, for instance, the attorney general of New York State, has done a remarkable job of forcing them to start turning over documents and disclose all that they knew. Unfortunately, we can't repair that damage. That quarter century that we lost to this charade turns out to be a critical quarter century in geological time. It means that now, instead of moving at a calm, measured, patient pace to address climate change, which we could have done a quarter century ago, now we have to go almost literally our hair's on fire, and we've got to figure out how to do this much faster than is economically or politically convenient. The good news is, and it is good news, that we kind of know the way out now. In the last 10 years, the engineers have done their job magnificently. They've cut the price of a solar panel by 80%. They've made wind power the cheapest way to generate electricity on this planet. And so if we really wanted to, if we could overcome the kind of dead grip of the fossil fuel industry, then we could make very quick progress here. So far, we haven't been willing to do that. Only a few countries have. And those that have demonstrated just how fast you can go. I mean, Denmark last year generated half their power from the wind. That's either because the Danes have figured out some way to corner the world's wind supply, or because they're just willing to put to use the technology that we all have. In fact, yesterday, Denmark changed the name of its national oil company to reflect the fact that it had sold off all its oil and gas interests and was now going to concentrate on renewable energy.
Environmentalist Bill McKibben is my guest. He'll be giving the Cockafair Chair Lecture this Friday in Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus. The 6:30 event is free and open to the public, but seating is limited. You can reserve your seat through the central ticket office. You can find a link on the up-to-date page. Bill, maybe a fundamental question here that a lot of people might be wondering right now. Is it too late or not?
Well, it's definitely too late to stop global warming. That's no longer on the list of options. So far, we've
and that means it's going to continue forever to some degree or another?
Forever is a very long time.
Okay.
But in terms of human lifetimes, human, our species, yes. We've raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit so far. Okay. That's caused the kind of damage that I've described so far. It's already the biggest thing humans have ever done. But we're on a path at the moment, even if all the countries kept the promises they made at Paris. And as you know, our country, the biggest contributor to carbon in the atmosphere, has decided that it will
back out.
Shamefully back down on its word. But even if everybody kept their word, the planet would still warm about 3.5 degrees Celsius, 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit, which is enough to put civilizations at serious risk. And so our job is to move much faster even than Paris imagines, which the renewable boom gives us the possibility to do, but only if we really go at it, Steve, the way, I mean, when I say that, I mean, only if we do work it the way that, say, our ancestors worked it when the enemy was fascism in Europe and we had to go to work converting factories to build munitions.
But Bill, you don't sense that that this nation is at the place you just described.
No, that's where we worked to get there. We were beginning to build up a little momentum in the wake of Paris, and people were beginning to understand things, and we're beginning to understand, probably most importantly, that we couldn't keep digging up more fossil fuel. We were beginning to succeed in many of these fights against pipelines and things. And Donald Trump obviously has put a crimp in that. He's the best friend the fossil fuel industry could have asked for. That doesn't mean that the activism and the movement has gone away. And in fact, we're continuing to rack up victories here and around the globe in certain ways. Just last week, the last of six proposed coal ports on the Pacific Northwest to ship coal from the American interior to Asia, the last of the six was defeated. None of these are going to be built. You know, earlier today, news came both that Scotland had banned fracking going forward, even though it's a big oil and gas country, and that 40 Catholic institutions had engaged in the largest act of religious divestment of fossil fuel stock yet, selling billions and billions of dollars worth of stock in the fossil fuel industry because these were rogue companies, mm-hmm. as it were. The one that was sweetest to me was seeing that the Diocese of Assisi in Italy, where St. Francis hailed from, had taken that step.
The Paris Agreement that you mentioned and our withdrawal from it, what's the significance of that move from your vantage point, Bill?
Well, it's clearly a great blow to the idea that the world could get together and go to work on a serious problem. We don't do it very often as a planet. This took an immense amount of effort. It was not, as I've said, a radical agreement by any means. It didn't come close to solving the problem, but it certainly at least finally got us started. And so the just sheer act of vandalism in saying we're not going to participate from the president was I don't know, I've made me feel ashamed. It really did. I'm a American patriot. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts. I spent my summer job was giving tours of the Battle Green, where America and United States in some ways began, you know. I just found it almost incomprehensible that the country that had been leading the world for so long would decide now that it was just going to take its, you know, grab its baseball and go home.
I was going to say, if environmentalists can't look to America to set an example for battling global warming, where can people turn?
Well, there are people who are starting to fill the gap. Some of them are the obvious ones. You know, if all the world was Scandinavia, we'd be okay. The other, more important because of size, is China. I think the Chinese, you know, who spent much of the last decade building a lot of coal-fired power and now produce daily more emissions than America, although obviously much less per capita, the Chinese are now installing renewable energy at a breakneck pace. There's two reasons for that. One, they're worried about climate change. Most of their manufacturing base is on the Pearl River Delta, which is low to the rising ocean. But they're also very worried about the other effects of burning coal and gas and oil, namely that people had a hard time breathing in their cities. They're mm-hmm. determined to make them cleaner. The real place to watch, I think, and in certain ways may be decisive, is what happens in India. And my guess is that the price of the rapidly falling price of renewable energy may mean that India skips a lot of the fossil fuel era and goes straight to renewables.
That's interesting.
I had the huge pleasure. I did a story for the New Yorker earlier this year where I was in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire and Tanzania, and it was unbelievably moving to watch people out in remote rural places who'd never had power ever getting their first power off a solar panel on the roof of their hut. They leapfrogged directly into the modern age. And with it, you know, I mean, I talked to people who'd never had a cold drink before in their life. And now, thanks to the power of the sun, there on the equator where it's 95 degrees all the time, they had something cold to drink.
What do you think, given that, the single most important thing that any of us can do to fight global warming, what is that thing?
Well, you know, I think that that's a really good question. Everybody used to, oh, well, change your light bulbs, put up solar panels. Those things are important. I mean, I'm speaking to you from my house, which is covered with solar panels, which are powering this computer connection. And I drove the first electric Ford in Vermont and on and on and on. But I don't try to fool myself that those are actually making much difference. Given where we are now, there's no way to make the math work one individual action at a time. What we have to do is come together and build the kind of movements on the sort of scale that can actually change policy enough here and around the world to make a difference. That's why we started organizations like 350.org, which I founded, which has become the first big global grassroots climate movement. Yeah. We do it because probably at this point, the most important thing an individual can do is not be so much of an individual, if you see what I mean. Come together in movements that change policy. That's how we won our, you know, so we won civil rights and how we won rights for gay people and women. And that's, I think, what we're going to have to do to match the overwhelming money power of the fossil fuel industry.
Bill McKibben's book, The End of Time, warned us all about global warming back in 1989. Again, he speaks in Kansas City on Friday at Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus at 6:30. The event is free. You can reserve a ticket through the central ticket office. You can find a link on the up-to-date page website. And Bill, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
A great pleasure to talk with you, Steve. Take care.
You bet. Sam Kosman has been exploring things for a long time now. When he was 7, he made a raft and floated the river behind his house as far as he could go just to see where it would take him. His latest adventure seems a little more high stakes, and no, I'm not talking about the interview he's about to do with me. Kosman traveled to Vanuatu, an island in the South Pacific, and descended into an active volcano crater not once, but 6 times. Here to tell us what possessed him to do just such a thing is Sam Kosman. And Sam, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I've seen the video online of this stuff, and it's just amazing. But surely this project wasn't just about capturing cool footage, or was it?
No. Well, you know, the first time I did it, actually, I was more drawn by the unknown and truly just kind of curious to see it for myself. It was a bit of an evolution, though. I've since gone back a couple of times, and each time I have, we've gone with different intentions, most recently to develop an early warning system for the millions of people that live around a new, newly formed lava lake of only 6 in the world.
Where is Vanuatu?
Vanuatu is a small island. It's about equidistant between Fiji and Australia. It's an archipelago of about 83 islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm. And why did you want to go there? What was the draw for you?
You know, a long time ago, I saw a video online of this nearly mythological-looking volcanic wonderland. I didn't even think it was real when I originally saw it with my own eyes, and I thought, I have to go here someday. I was just drawn to the fact that a place like this even existed on the planet. And so I took some time to plan this project, but it never actually happened. It was very expensive, dangerous, as you could imagine, complex to put together. And it wasn't until years later that the project actually reemerged as a film opportunity by a major network, and I got invited to tag along.
What was the network?
It was BBC, actually.
Yeah. Well, here I saw the footage, and it just is—it's breathtaking. You're standing in front of this active volcano, and there's lava flying all over the place. How close did you get to it?
About as close as you'd want to get.
Which is what?
We were probably about 30 feet away from the lava itself. It took about 3 or 4 hours to descend into the crater. It's about the vertical height of the Empire State Building. And when you get to the bottom, you can actually walk to the very ledge, and in front of you, a geyser of lava is spewing over your head, probably 30 to 40 feet. It's like staring at the surface of the sun.
And I should point out that you just couldn't walk towards the edge of this volcano just wearing what you're wearing in front of me right now. You had a special silver suit on that must have been very protective in nature. Tell us about that thing.
Yeah, so there's no such thing as a lava suit or a volcano suit. We simply repurposed existing tools that were out there used by steel mill workers and firefighters. It was an aluminized heat suit made by a company called Nutex. And essentially, it can take a splash of molten material up to 3,000 degrees for just a few seconds. But
if something had hit you, you could have survived it.
Possibly, but the tricky part is that lava, even though it looks like it's in this fluid state, has the same density as rock. So even if this light-looking material were to come your way, one, it could knock you out, and two, it could burn a hole straight through you if it lasted for any longer than just a few seconds.
I couldn't tell how much of it was photography wizardry, but the film made it look like the stuff was you're underneath a fireworks show in a sense. There was lava bouncing all over the place.
Yeah, it was unlike anything that I've ever seen with my own eyes. The first time I went there, I was just completely awestruck by this force of nature that it was really humbling. You know, you don't think about the forces that you're standing on underlying our planet, you know, when you're walking around going about your busy day. But the reality is we're standing on a rock that's swirling throughout space that's, you know, underneath the surface of which is molten material that's churning every day, completely indifferent to our existence here on the surface. So it's a pretty fascinating thing to see with your own eyes.
I should point out that Sam, the reason we're talking to Sam is he'll be at the Linda Hall Library on Wednesday evening at 7 for an event they're calling simply Journey into an Active Volcano, which is exactly what Sam Kosman did. More information, go to lindahall.org. Could you hear it as you're standing on the edge there? Does it make a sound?
Oh, yeah. It's a unrecognizable sound. It sounds like a freight train. It basically, you can feel the rumble. It sounds like a raging waterfall of lava. It sounds like an ocean waves crashing on the shore all around you. It's a deafening sound, actually.
And can you, even inside this fantastic suit, could you feel the heat, Sam?
Oh, yeah. It's about 1,000 degrees at the edge.
1,000 degrees.
By the time you're standing at the edge, you're pretty much needing to take a few steps back already because your heat shield is the visor that's gold-plated, a similar kind of technology that astronauts use to protect them from the ultraviolet radiative heat in space. It started melting. And our GoPros and other camera equipment were melting as well. You can only stand there for a few seconds before you have to take some steps back to safety.
And when you step back, the temperature would drop dramatically, I think?
Yeah, it's pretty linear. And it's also greatly influenced by line of sight. So if you hide behind a rock, you know, the temperature cuts off really quickly. But it's not somewhere you want to stay for a long time. We were down there simply initially just to get some, you know, unique footage and you know, satisfy our own intellectual curiosities of this, you know, amazing place that so few people have been before. But later, as I continued exploring volcanoes, I realized that they are they're such fertile ground for discovery because we know so little about them and so few people go there. And it reminded me that there's probably a lot of other places in the world just like that. So, mm-hmm. I think what really motivates me to continue doing this is this great irony, which is, one, that we are living in a time where natural disasters are increasing with frequency every single day. And two, we live in a time where we've never been more connected with each other, had better access to technology and information. And yet, you know, we have great problems, unsolved problems in the world. And I think there's an opportunity to bridge that gap.
Did you worry as you were standing on the edge that you might get lightheaded? And I mean, was that a danger at that point?
You know, I think the first time around, I didn't even realize what the dangers were. I just went there and perhaps a little bit naive to some of the risks. The second and third and fourth time I went back to this lava lake and others, I realized that we probably needed to take better precautions. So we had a lot of plans and evacuation methodologies to limit and mitigate the risks.
I'm told now that the volcano you visited on Vanuatu, fewer people have stepped foot down there than on the moon. Do I have that right?
That is correct, at least at the time. Since then, there's been only a couple of groups that have gone down there. It's extremely difficult to get to. You need to have some very specialized material as well as expertise. There's only one route that could really take you down there moderately safely, and only a handful of people know it. So yes, that's true.
And not to belabor the point, but are you feeling the heat as soon as you begin your descent? Is it that kind of thing?
You do. You don't need the suit for the majority of the descent. And
right.
And actually, what's rather interesting is because of the walls themselves are rather concave and inverted, the heat gets trapped closer towards the top of your descent. So as you actually go down towards the bottom, it gets cooler, of course, until the time that you approach the lava lake itself, which, of course, it gets very hot again.
Now, you said one of your purposes here, Sam, was to develop some sort of early warning system for the people who live around there. Tell us how that might work.
Sure. So originally, as I mentioned, the plan was just to go and get some footage. But when I came back from that and had the unique opportunity to have a video go viral, my very first YouTube video that I posted online, I realized that there was so much more to spending time in a place like this that, you know, I barely scratched the surface. And so I decided to look at, you know, ways that we could use technology to learn more about volcanoes. And the more I learned, the more I realized that there are hundreds of millions of people around the world that live close to these threats. And so it's a little bit of a meandering story, but the crux of it is that basically with sensors, we could actually detect patterns in the volcanic structure across a variety of different instruments and use artificial intelligence to look for precursors that could provide early warning those living in the regions.
Based on temperature fluctuations and all kinds of factors.
Anything
right?
that you can measure on a volcano, whether it's gravity or seismic data, pressure, temperature, all of these parameters can be looked at in contrast and comparison to one another. And then you can look for indications that are precursors based upon your own human observations of a given event. In our case, most recently, we tested this theory in Nicaragua on a volcanic project that was supported by General Electric.
Right.
And we managed to find a few rather unusual, previously unknown statistical anomalies that helped kind of pave the way for what was possible moving forward on early warning systems.
Because sometimes when these things erupt, they erupt very, very quickly and unexpectedly. Do I have that right?
That's right. Yeah, most people are given very little notice, unfortunately. Even right now, there are a few volcanoes in the world that are on the verge of eruption. I think in Indonesia, almost 150,000 people were just forced to evacuate their homes. And usually, they're not given a whole lot of warning. So we're hoping to improve upon that.
Give us the volcano 101 here, if you would, Sam. What is the basic rundown on the anatomy of a volcano?
Well, you have lots of different types of volcanoes, so it would be difficult to summarize in one brief description. But essentially, you have a pool of lava, and it can be varying depths depending upon how close it is to the surface is usually related to how dangerous it can be. And then, of course, there are the structures around it with different plumbing, essentially. And depending upon the materials that are in that plumbing and the amount of gas, the pressure can build over time. And if there's not a way for the degassing to take place for pressure to be alleviated, they can blow.
Why is there lava to begin with? I mean, what causes that?
The simple answer is that there's a tremendous amount of energy in the inside the planet. The plates are overlapping and converging with one another, forcing this tremendous energy expulsion. And all of that heat melts the material around it, and then it just stays in the form of lava until it's forced outward, creating land where there wasn't any before.
So where are you going next?
You know, believe it or not, it's not a volcano project.
Really?
I'm taking a break from volcanoes after living in one for the last 2 months.
You want to cool off a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The next project's actually focused, it's related to volcanoes, interestingly enough. We had looked at how we could use sensors and artificial intelligence to extract insights that could be useful to people. And we realized that we could actually apply that same logic to other problems in the world. And the problem that we landed at was one related to wildlife conservation and illegal poaching, conservation specifically. We were looking to create a an early warning system, if you will, for the rangers who are on the front lines and oftentimes don't know when and where poaching events are taking place.
To warn them that certain poachers might be in this sector or that sector, that kind of
thing. Exactly, and to provide, to decrease the response time to essentially get the bad guys.
Is it going to work?
I hope so. It's proven technology that's been used by the military and law enforcement for a long time. It's just never been applied in this environment. So we're hoping to repurpose that.
Sam Kosman will be at the Linda Hall Library 7 o'clock Wednesday evening for an event called Journey into an Active Volcano. More information, lindahall.org. Sam, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much
for
having me.
Be safe out there, okay?
Will do.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, meet the director bringing the play Fences to life at the KC Rep, and we'll talk with two veterans in the fight to stop violence in Kansas City. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.